Welcome to the FinTech Scaly Show. This podcast is sponsored by ScaleUp Consulting, helping FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. Now, over to the show with Richard Doty, founder and host. Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Mark Vedel, founder of InScale. Mark is an amazing entrepreneur. I've known him for a few years and very excited to have him on the show today. He has built up with his own two hands InScale over the last 15 odd years. InScale is now a global business. It's got operations in Lisbon, Kiev, Kuala Lumpur, I think Denmark, and also in London, where Mark resides. So listen, Mark, awesome to finally get you on the show and great to have you. How are things going today?
Thank you, Richard. Everything's going very well here. Yeah.
Cool.
So, good sunny day.
Yeah. It is. It's good. Spring's in the air. So, listen, let's kick off the show. And I think the founder's story is a good way to set the narrative for our listeners. And what I'm going to pose to you right now to kick off the show is, why entrepreneurship, Mark? Why take the path less trodden?
Yeah, it started when I was 10 years old and I was in my primary school, and there came an anthropologist who made a slideshow of the cannibals in Papua New Guinea. And I said to myself when I was 10, when I grow up, I'm going to go there. I'm going to go there. And then time went on, and I got an education. I became a Master of Science in Mechanical Engineering, just finished that. And then I was on a fencing tournament, and one of the friends I stayed with, they had a business in Bali where they imported clothes from Bali and sold them in Denmark. And they were going to Indonesia. And so I kind of decided that I just inherited some money from my grandfather, and he traveled a lot. He was in the Air Force. And I decided I would go and visit them, go for a month. And they stayed in Bali. And that's back in 88 when, you know, Bali was not so overrun with tourists. And so I got the ticket, and I realized then that half of the Papua New Guinea was in Indonesia. So I kind of made it the mission to go to see these cannibals that I promised myself. So it was like 1 month in Indonesia, traveling around a little bit easy. And then I spent 1 month to Irian Jaya, that's the Indonesian part of Papua New Guinea. And it was just like me, cannibals, and jungle, like no friends, no guide, nothing. Just I went there, one of the missionary planes dropped me off on a hilltop, and suddenly I was surrounded by 100 hungry people of color who took me into their hut. And then I talked to the chieftain, and then I arranged that the chief's son would take me to the next village. And that's how it continued for about a month. I was also sailing a week on a hollow tree trunk in the Esmet area. That's where Rockefeller's son was eaten accidentally some years earlier. And it kind of showed me that you can do things you want. I mean, if you wanted, you just do it. It's not, you don't need approval. You don't need to have it planned and all laid out. Then shortly after, I got a job in Bang & Olufsen, and I left that to get a job at CERN, Center of European Nuclear Research. Now, that was great. On my thesis, it said computer integrated manufacturing. I had done all the manufacturing, and my friend had done all the computing. Actually, I hadn't touched a computer in my life other than the text editing. I'd just written the thesis on a text editor. That was the only exposure to IT I'd had. And I became project manager of an enormous IT project. And there were three basic problems with that assignment. One was I had never touched a computer. Second, I didn't speak a word of French, and it was all in French. I mean, nobody spoke English in the project. And then it was all about asset management, maintenance management, stock management, of which I knew nothing either. So I had zero competences on all three of the key things you needed. So honestly, the first year was a bit of a struggle, but then it became very good. It became a very successful project. They still use the system. It's still in use today, and it's the biggest implementation of that software in the world. So,
listen, I mean, that's really interesting. There's a couple of things there. So one is, when you started out in your career, there was a lack of understanding of language, which is in this case, French. And then let's go rewind even further back to when you met the cannibals, because this is interesting, right? I don't want to ask you what survival kit you took along with you, but I'm going to ask you, how did you communicate with these guys? I mean, again, that's probably a foreign language. You said you spoke to the chief. Was it sign language?
The problem was one had no map. Only the army military had maps. So you had no maps of the area at that time. So I'd drawn a map on a checkered bit of paper with the pilot, one of the pilots. And so I knew the names of the villages. And they had quite kind of a village would be like 150 to 150 inhabitants. I knew the names, and I knew about how long it was. So the first time I actually had a bit of a kind of an instant, because the pilot said it was one day's march from this village. He set me off at, to the next one. And I insisted, like, with showing what the sun and the moon, and I could kind of communicate the sun and the moon. And then one day, we kind of could communicate after a couple of hours what one day meant. And I said it was one day to go. And they said it was 2 days. And I said one day. And I was kind of quite used to that. My will was strong. I mean, I wanted it my way, which I had to kind of. So they woke me up at 5 a.m, three guys. And they, because I had a rucksack, and it just turned out it was like 14 hours of 2 hours down, 2 hours up, 2 hours down, 2 hours up. And they needed three people to carry my rucksack for 14 hours. They couldn't do it in one. If you needed to do it in one day, you had to get up at 5 a.m. So I realized that they actually knew more about the ground than I did, and I should listen also. But I was quite headstrong at that time. So I'd heard it was one day, and then it was one day. So communication was very difficult, very difficult. They spoke a little bit of Indonesian, but I didn't speak Indonesian. So they had their own cannibal, I mean, tribal. I mean, Papua New Guinea has 45% of all languages in the world on the island. So every single tribe has a different language. So you, of sign language and a bit of kind of.
You got by, but it sounds like also, it sounds like there's a bit of resilience and a bit of grit required to last a month out in cannibal country. And, you know, listen, you're here today talking about the tales. So, and that's, I guess, also part and parcel of what it takes to set up on your own and build a company and succeed.
And the trip was completely planned. Like I had didn't even have walking shoes. I had my sailors, you know, the slippery sailor shoes, which was quite slippery in the mountains, which was not a very good. And these guys were like really strong. Once I was walking, it was an older guy. He was quite old. He took me from one village and I slipped off the path and he grabbed me and he was like 60 or something and thin, but he grabbed me and he lifted me in one arm. He lifted me up and put me back on the trail. I thought, gosh, I didn't want to fight with the younger and stronger men. I mean, they were like massively strong. So, but it was great fun and it was a really good trip, except of course the food was sweet potatoes shoved in the fire for 1 hour. That was kind of the menu all 30 days.
You're going to get fit out there, right? And what lessons did you take out of there that helped you in your first project combating? You didn't know how to project, well, you're new to project management, you're in a new environment, you didn't understand the lingo. You know, there must be some things you took out of that experience that helped it become a success.
Well, I think the kind of, when I see I want the goal, I'm not too worried about, I don't know how to get there. The obstacles, I know I can fix them. They'll resolve themselves as you go along. And I think, if I can take a conclusion, and I think maybe we can come back to that, is that when the path is not clear, when everything is opaque, most people, they freeze and say, oh, I can't do that. You know, well, how do we get there? Where do we stay? What do we eat? You know, they plan all things, and the plan is very complicated, and they stop. And I don't. I see, I want to get there, and then I'm going to figure it out. I'll find some way I'll figure it out. And I became quite confident on that. Also, with the job at CERN, I had no idea about computing. I had no idea about French. I just took the project management role. I was actually Shanghai. They kind of said I was hired to do something different. But after 8 days, my boss came, oh, Mark, could you do this instead? And he actually already planned me to do that all the time. I knew he'd tricked me into doing it. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I had no idea how to do it. I had no skills to do it. The low point was that it had been taken care of by an intern, an English woman. And she said, yeah, let's have a handover. And I came for a 1 hour meeting. Here's the mainframe. Here's the password. Here's the Oracle Forms manual. Here's the Oracle Database manual. Have a nice day. And she left. And that was it. And I was like, and the manuals were like 1,200 pages each. And it was like a little bit of a read. And there was a password for the mainframe, the VAX VMS. And that was the Oracle Database. That was the project. And it was like nobody there, nobody to help. And 4 years later, it was a thriving thing, very well implemented. It was difficult along the way. Then I left CERN to start my first company in Denmark. And that was a kind of a little bit of an ease. That was a maybe, but that was to distribute that software I'd implemented at CERN. It was an Info software, maintenance asset management. And I implemented that and I got it sold and implemented to all the big asset owners in Denmark, like Danish Rail, Danish Energy, all the power plants, all the big asset owners. I sold and implemented that. And that was also difficult because I had no idea how to sell something. I had no idea how to run a company. I'd never started a company, never hired anybody. So it's just all these things. And then I had a big thing happening. I had a very, very serious traffic accident. And I broke my spine. I broke my legs. I was 6 months in hospital. And in that process, we sold that company. Luckily, because it needed some work, and I was not able to do that. I was like away for a year. Got the company sold, and I got a job, and I realized I worked in corporate life, where I also realized, also at CERN, that corporate life is not me. I'm not going to I can't function in this kind of middle manager here, and I need to impress my boss so I get promoted to the next level. I'm too impatient to wait for other people to promote me. Yeah. I think that was kind of the feeling that I need other people to then say, yes, we all want Mark to be the next level. And then maybe after 40 years, I can become, yeah, it's just like, no, I want to do it myself.
Yeah.
So it was very clear that I wanted to achieve something and I didn't have the patience to wait for the corporate. So I started the first company, sold it, got a job, was there for 5 years, got married, had two kids with my wife, and we were very happy, like an ideal family. Great house, amazing house with an outdoor fireplace, enormous garden, suburbs of Copenhagen, two wonderful kids, a dog, two cars, everything perfect. And I come home from work one day and my wife says, I want to go home. And I said, darling, we are home. No, she wanted to go home to Malaysia. She's from Kuala Lumpur and she's had it with the Danish weather. I can understand that. It's Danish weather is not really for humans. It's always raining and cold and slush and dark. And we had two kids, like the idea of kind of splitting up and she go home and I stay was like off, not on the table for me. So that evening we decided to go to Kuala Lumpur. I had no really idea where that was, but I'm sure it was a nice place. So next day I put the house on sale. It was sale within 8 days. Then I quit my job. We packed everything up and went to Kuala Lumpur. And on the way there, I kind of like, what should I do in Kuala Lumpur? You know? We got a bit of money out of the house, but it wasn't going to last forever. So it was like one of my friends had started an offshore company in India doing SAP development outsourcing. And I thought,
just to pause there for a second. I mean, how long ago was this? This is what 15, 16, 17 years ago?
This was in 2005, yeah.
2005, okay, cool.
Summer 2005, yeah. I landed in, I think it was October, we came, and I had a bit of a travel backwards and forwards. I had to kind of clear up the house. Then I started the company in Kuala Lumpur. And I mean, you start a company, this is a new country, all laws are different. And Kuala Lumpur is not less complicated. I mean, Denmark is much easier. This was really complicated. And they have all sorts of complicated governance laws about companies. It's much more regulated than one should think. So I went through all that. I started the company. We got this special status in Kuala Lumpur called MSC status, which gives us the ability to attract foreign tech talent, which is really good. And then I just trotted along trying to find, what would the business be? And initially I had like other ideas, but then it kind of formulated into this outsourced development offshore. And we worked getting customers, and very lucky, very early on, we got SAP as a customer. Oh. I'd actually planned this event, an event in Copenhagen and with the Danish ITO Association. And it was a bit of a disaster because nobody came. Like we were 17 participants at an event. But I had come with three speakers and they'd come with three speakers. And one of the speakers was SAP. So all these speakers, but no participants. And they met one of our developers that I'd brought along to the event. And they were actually planning to go somewhere else. And then they said, let's try and see how it is in Kuala Lumpur. So they came by and I was actually not there. For some reason, I was in Denmark there. So he came to visit, site visit. And he said, look, if it's like this when the boss isn't there, then it must be good.
And so, and just to step back a second. So, you're now in Kuala Lumpur, new business, you finally figured out there's some opportunity from an outsource point of view. And how did you find that opportunity? I mean, was it a case of talking to contacts, or was it a case of going to, I don't know, events? I mean, you know, this is back in 2005. So,
now. That has a story. So, I was really wanted to do SAP because in my previous company, we were competing against SAP. And I always thought we should have joined them rather than compete. We should have become an SAP implementer rather than trying to compete with them because we were losing that battle against SAP. It was getting too strong. So I had this kind of, I wanted to work in SAP. So I was running around talking to the Danish SAP providers. And it turned out some were too big, like IBM, and they have their own. Some are too small. They're just a handful. Because there was very few, very little market. We ended up actually closing two of these. Out of the five there were, we closed two. And then I was working with the providers in Kuala Lumpur, but they were difficult to work with because they were used to sending big bills and I look white and they take advantage of that. You can get it's called a Masale, and it's actually an acronym for Mad Sailor. That's what they call white people. And you get a Masale pricing. So they have a Masale pricing. So there's no rebate if you're European. And I was struggling that. Then one of my friends said, hey, I got this other friend I met called Tony. He needs some developers. This is something you could figure out. And to cut a long story short, I kind of talked to him and I set up, this is the team we could do the outsourced development to us. And I could set up this team. Then he asked, so what would it cost? And then there was a long pause because I hadn't really thought of that, actually. I actually hadn't thought of what the price would be. So I said, Tony, can I get back to you in a couple of days? And he said, yeah, fine, no worries. And I went back. And actually, that was the, and I thought about it. And then I made the model, which is basically the model we've got today with a little bit of tweaking.
But it is, it's not just outsourcing, is it? I mean, it's something a bit special and a bit unique in the markets that you came up with, right?
Yeah. So we, well, for lots of different reasons, we decided to focus on companies who develop their own software. So rather than take projects that have a time limit, we thought also for stability, and I didn't have any venture backing or anything, just like the house money, and that was long gone. So I wanted something that was quite sticky with the customers, that where the customer said, this is really important, we want to keep this not just for 1 year, we want to do this for 10 years. So how do I make a service that customers want for 10 years? And roughly half the software companies do projects, and the other half develop products. And the larger banks, they would do their internal applications. So we kind of geared the whole service of the customers. Let's just focus on that half of the market that develop their own IP, that develop their own. And how can we be interesting for that? How can they give us the confidence to have their intellectual property developed in our centers? And how, what do we need to do? So we built the company all around that. But it had, so I was very conscious about that because I'd worked, before I worked for Teachernator, the one who bought my first company. And I knew that, so there was kind of two things I was thinking. We could either do all models, so time and material, fixed price, team model, you know, long-term development model, but then have one skill like .NET or Java. Just pick one skill at random and say, we are Ruby on Rails experts, we'll do everything in Ruby on Rails. As long as it's Ruby on Rails, we can do it. Or we could say, no, we have this long-term model, but then we can do all skills. And I was thinking a bit about that. And then I knew that the larger companies were quite promiscuous with skills. They would always use lots of different skills. So I knew if you wanted the larger companies, you couldn't just focus on one skill. You would be always be left out on the other skill. So I chose, and that was the reason I chose to go for the long-term model and all the skills. So we do all skills from mainframe to Flutter to .NET, Python, Perl, you name it. We do any skill as long as it's to develop your own product. And then we're the best. I think we are the best provider in the, available.
Yeah, and then you decided on a price. You got back to Tony.
He said yes. He actually said, "How can you live on such a low? I mean, this is so cheap, you know." Because he was working with one freelance in Copenhagen. Okay, that is also expensive, and the whole team was half the price of that, and that was two C++ developers and one tester.
Oh wow.
So for half the price, and I was thrown in as a product owner.
That's a good deal.
Yeah, he got a really good deal. We made a really good product for him.
And then you scaled it up. I mean, you bought in different players. You had a base from Kuala Lumpur.
Yeah, so very early on, I got in the partner because, I don't know, maybe... So I think my skill is that kind of getting from zero to one, getting the project off, doing the impossible. A little bit like Sherlock Holmes, you could say, in the film. But building an organization is a different skill. And I kind of knew I didn't have that skill. And Henrik is a much more eye for organization and structures. And so he came in quite early. He was actually a customer of ours. And he was in Kuala Lumpur. And we kind of got along well. And we talked about it. And then we decided that he just became partner, equal partner of the company. I mean, he put a little money in. And then we were partners together, and that worked well because he needed to go back to Denmark, and then we were one in Denmark and one in Europe and one in Kuala Lumpur, and then we switched around, and then we were like one in each place. But I think what we then realized was that for the mid-sized tech company, Kuala Lumpur was quite far away. That was kind of our challenge. So if you are in London, if you're in Stockholm, if you're in Copenhagen, and you're just a developing, if you're like 25 developers and you want to grow to 40, 50 developers, going to Kuala Lumpur just to get the tech talent is a bit far. You've got time difference, you've got physical difference. So you might prefer to go to Ukraine or to Lisbon or Spain, places that are closer. So we kind of figured that we needed to get some locations that were closer to the customers, that were our main customers. And that's why we first started Macedonia, which was also... That was started because we had an employee working for us who was from Macedonia, and he kind of, his father was in the politics, and we met some of the ministers, and we kind of got a very good impression of the country, and we started the company there. But now we're one of the largest IT companies in Macedonia.
And what was, because again, coming back to that survival, the cannonball, the guy that's not really liking structures, the founder, the visionary, the pioneer, which is you, Mark. I mean, what was your involvement in building out these structures, or were you more, okay, Henrik, you go on, get this done, that's your sort of cup of tea, and I'm going to be looking at new ventures? Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see the makeup.
Yeah, so we were quite clear that my competences are not in the, I didn't have any grandeur delusions that I would be the best person to build an organization. So I left that to Henrik, and he's got to build, we've got a fantastic management team that does that and make sure that, you know, we are incredibly structured actually as a company, but it's not my doing. So I can't take credit for that. That has nothing to do with me. No, I'm better. Let's say you say, Mark, we need to build up in the US, go over there and fix it. That's kind of what I'm really good at. And I think, so now I'm in London to build up the market in London. And I said to them, but we don't have any employees in London. And they said, yes, Mark, that's why
you need to. That's why you're there.
Yeah, that's why you're there. Can't have you with anybody else.
So you went to Macedonia, then you went to Lisbon, Kiev.
Well, actually, we sent this. He was a sales assistant we'd hired from. He was there, and then we very quickly on hired a site manager.
Yeah, makes sense.
So we got was the former ambassador to Denmark of Macedonia, and he's a wonderful person. And we get somebody in the site to manage the site. You need a local manager who knows the. It's difficult to manage from the distance. We have a global management team, the sites actually help each other out. So they are sites, they're independent, but they also, the Macedonian site could be helping recruiting for the Ukrainian site and vice versa. So it's kind of like a matrix organization where, but that is not my, I can't really tell much about, except of course I know about it, but we are not much involved in that part.
But as a founder, I'm just trying to get the insight. So you came up with this really clever idea that penetrated a need or a pain in the market. You brought in a management team. But what's been your journey? How have you made certain that you sort of work on the business rather than in the business, i.e. in the structure? What have you put in place to get the best out of Mark?
Well, the best out of Mark would be to go to something new. And that's why I'm in London. So I've been here for 3 years and we're having some success. We've got quite a number of UK customers and that's growing. Mm-hmm. And when hopefully soon we got a proper office with 5 salespeople and assistants, I would have done that. Then I probably need to look at something else, because probably there would be a better sales manager to hire rather than me to make. So that would be the project, is to get this area. So we've got our sales director is director of all the sales and marketing and takes care of Scandinavia. And then I'm taking care of UK and also some of the continental, if there's a customer in Belgium or France, then I'll also look at that. But so it is that project to build up. And that's an important thing, because if we build up a proper sales team in UK, well, then we are probably a couple of thousand employees by then and things are going good. Then I don't know, then the next job could be to go to the US or maybe just do acquisitions or... I don't know. That's not really defined yet what that would be.
Again, I was wondering, I mean, because it's just going through this. I mean, so you, the founder, you've built the company, you've got the management structure in place. You're now leading a pivotal part of it, which is obviously the London and UK markets, and maybe later on some other parts of it. How's your interaction? Maybe this is what I'm, how's your interaction with the other parts of the organization, being that entrepreneur, maybe that free spirit that it goes off and sort of gets stuff done out of the structure.
Okay, I know where you're going, and we didn't even prepare this, but this
we
is
didn't.
This is the dentist has found the tooth that is not working. So I have 2 roles. I'm on the board, but I'm also a junior. You know, my boss is the Danish sales director, so I have a boss, and his. So I'm 2 levels down in the organization wise, and it's just a normal sales manager, you would call that, with no employees under me. So they made sure of that. And I have to fit into the organization. And that is a struggle. I mean, it's not it's more difficult than the trek in Jaya with the cannibals. That was easier. So put it in perspective. That was easy. This is, I just put in process. I kind of pull myself together and say, yes, I have to, an organizational player also. But it is not natural for me. It's something I have to make a deliberate, conscious effort to do. While other people just fit into an organization and they have this role and they're doing that role and they do it very well, I would more belonging to, let me get some new project that is greenfield that I can kind of figure out myself. It would be more natural for me.
And tell me more about you. I mean, your interests outside of InScale and building that. I mean, you're an entrepreneur. I know that in the heart and in the soul. So there must be other ventures or other activities that you do to get those sort of juices flowing and to keep on sort of top of the ideas and keep on top of your game, right?
Yeah, I have one sport I really love, and that's fencing. So I'm an absolutely passionate fencer. And of course, the lockdown has been quite, I think they got fencing mixed up with wrestling. So it's got into that category where we have a mask, but you have to have two masks and stuff like that. So it's been quite badly hit by the lockdown. So fencing is my big sports passion, and I do that. So I used to sneak along to some World Cup tournaments when I was younger, and now I've got my eye up on the veteran. Maybe I could do the veteran. But it's difficult because when you get older, I got an elbow injury last year before the COVID, and I'm a bit dreading what will happen when it opens up in May, but I'll be back there. And then I've taken up tennis.
Yeah.
Nice. Which is nice. I live in Ealing, and tennis, there's so many tennis courts, so it's kind of quite a natural thing to. And that opens up, that's already opened up. So I'm actually looking forward to maybe getting to play some tennis. So it's that. And I've got my children, I see, which is, they're great fun. I like traveling. Everybody likes traveling. So it's quite standard things. Yeah.
Because as you go through that journey, and I've got friends and others that have been along that path, and the interests at certain points in their journey shift, and the shift to investing or shift to non-executive director positions or shift to advisors on startups or scale-ups. Have you given that any thought? And if you had, it'd be great to get some insights.
Yeah, I mean, that could be interesting. I haven't yet done it. I haven't even been in talks with anybody serious about doing it. But, you know, if that could be interesting, it could be fun to. I've been around the block a couple of times and could probably help people, you know, what to do, what not to do. And the advisory role would also be good because I wouldn't need to have organizational skills to do that. It wouldn't require me to become ingrained in their management. But right now, I'm also quite busy with the InScale. I mean, we've had the COVID. It's kind of like not the worst thing that could happen, but it's not the best thing either. Mm. But that could be an option. Looking at that's the kind of thing that I could look into. And that might be a good, I think in the first run, it would be a supplement. So not like a full-scale non-executive director, but it might be following one tech company or two, helping them along the way. That could be interesting, but not something that would interfere with my full-time job.
No, yeah. And you mentioned, you know, InScale and COVID. How do you guys cope with that? You know, I've seen various things happen in the tech world. There's different stories, but yeah, it would be good to hear how you guys have trodden your way through it.
Well, a few of our customers got quite badly hit, and with them, that was, of course, an issue. But the most of the customers have been just weathering it. And as we develop their core product, we help their team develop their core product. Then it's an area that doesn't kind of get cut.
Yeah.
Even if the business is not growing, you still need to develop your core product. So, and actually our customers have been quite happy and have been growing since during the crisis. So our existing customers have grown quite considerably, most of them.
Okay, that's cool, Mark. I mean, what about sales? I mean, how is that, or new business? How have you guys had to adapt in the new world? Or have you had to adapt as sort of the coronavirus has hit over the last sort of 12 months or so?
Well, I mean, sales, we have some customers who contact us, and that hasn't changed. That's just our presence. And we also get some customers from existing customers. Mm. But our main outreach was actually participating at physical events. Yeah. Which has been very, very badly hit, of course, non-existent for 1 year. So that has been a really difficult learning process to how do we actually tell about our story? Because we're quite invisible because we work very closely with our customers, so they know us very well, but we're not kind of always out marketing because all our engagements are incredibly long-term, helping the customer build their products, their core software solutions. And so we're not, it's a little bit like the white labeled fintech product that might be all over the place, but you just don't know about it. And that's a little bit our problem, is that we're a little bit invisible in the, it is in the nature of what we do. It's not about InScale. It's about the customer's product and them getting the best talent in the world to build their best product. So all our companies are about combining top talent with interesting companies that are progressive businesses that are going somewhere. So we don't want to be the kind of hiring, you know, medium good people at a low cost for companies who are not very nice to work for. We want to go for the interesting customers who have growth and have interesting job opportunities, and then find the best people to do that. So that's kind of that's where we evolved. And all the talent acquisition has also evolved a lot since I started, with a lot of, we do a lot of personality testing and stuff, but it is in that nature very invisible what we do. So yeah, we were going to conferences and then meeting people there, and now we can't do that. So that has hurt a bit. But it's currently I'm still working with the customers I met at the conferences the last 2 years. So they're the ones that are, and then we do also reach out to other customers directly, and that has also given some feedback. But it's not as, and also some of the market has been, I mean, a lot of companies have just kind of taking a pause and seeing where this goes before they kind of, it's a major decision to say, look, I want to have a development center in Lisbon, or you know, I want to have a development center in Ukraine, in Kiev or Skopje or Kuala Lumpur. It's not just something you do because you just need a couple of people for a short-term problem. And we don't want to be that. So it's quite a strategic decision. So it's also a big decision for companies to go into, to set up a development center outside their home country. And so that has been, so I'm really looking forward to Boris Johnson's pints in the pub, you know.
We were speaking before the call. We said we should have, because it's a sunny day in London, we were saying we should be having this podcast off the game of tennis and sipping our finest. And I agree, right? We need to, hopefully soon we're going to be all opening up and getting out there to not just do business, but also to interact with people, right? Because it is a people's business.
It is. And I'm quite confident that the vaccines, with the ups and downs that are with that, are going to be successful in getting everything back to normal. And I think that as soon as that's rolled out, so UK first and then Europe later, so probably in the end of the year and then next year, things will be more or less back to normal. I think, of course, there will probably be some winter wave coming in November, but let's take those sorrows when they come. And so we're very much looking forward to getting back into being able to meet people. But we're working on we're finding a way. The way is not clear. And that's what I'm trying. I must admit, this is more struggling than the jungle trek. But
lockdown has been tough. And listen, I mean, as we close up and wind up the show, I mean, what are you doing as a founder, as a business owner? What are you looking for? You know, what questions are you asking yourself? And what sort of factors are you, Mark, considering as you scale up your business, but also move to a new part of the journey?
And my main focus is to scale the business.
Yeah.
Because 50% is actually moving more and more towards product companies. So a higher proportion of the companies in the world develop products. People don't, you have long customization projects anymore. That was in the old days we did that. So the market is moving in our direction, you could say. And we need to just to scale. And when it scales, I mean, really scales, I mean, yeah, there will be questions. What do I do in the organization? Do I still want to be a junior sales manager, you know, three levels down, getting in my quota of deals? Or would I? I think that's a bridge I would take when I'm crossing it. There could be lots of different avenues for that, for me personally. But I mean, I love my business. I think I saw about Facebook when Thiel and Zuckerberg were like, they got an offer from Yahoo for $1 billion to buy it. And then Zuckerberg said, no, if he got the money, he would just start a new social website, and he quite liked the one he's got. And I've got the same thing, you know, if I didn't have anything to do, I'd make a new nearshore company, and I actually quite like the one I've got. So yeah. I don't have any sales plan of the company. I see myself having a major role in InScale the next 20 years at least. So that's it. Whether it will be a different role, probably will be in 4 or 5 years' time, probably a different role, but still a strong role in the company.
And so all the founders out there that maybe have been in the game, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, what advice would you give to them now? As they scale up their company.
Persevere. I think I've been advising some startups in my early days, and I see some of them, I mean, some companies do need big investment and you need your funding, because otherwise, if your business is more service business like mine, I think you more need some customers. So I think the best thing you can do is get some key customers. And I also realize that in the beginning, you're looking very broad, but you quickly need to narrow down and focus. The more you focus on something small, and the more narrow that is, the more it is tech companies in the northwest of the UK. That kind of, the more you narrow it down, the better, the more easier it is to be successful. I think that's it. And then I think, you know, well, it's difficult to advise other people, but one should probably, in my kind of business, stay on with it longer than just kind of building it up some years and then trying to move on to something different. I believe in it, doing the long run for it. But that's different from business, and it's also different from person. So you have to look. I think always a company plan has to follow a life plan. And your life plan has to come first. So you have to have a life plan. And then when you have a life plan, then you can make a company plan or your role in the company plan, and then you have to fit that in and then build and attract. I mean, the advice I can give is quite standard. I mean, find great partners, hire great people, be selective with your customers. It's a
all salient points and all very good points, right? As people build up. And also, I mean, I quite liked your points around, you know, be for the long haul, be persistent and don't give up.
Yeah, I think you can always honk. I mean, it of course depends on your business, but really, if there are difficulties, you can overcome them. And then when you overcome them, the economy goes in waves. And it's the ones that survive the troughs that rise when the things pick up. Actually, when I started InScale, we really got the business going in 2008. And I had some customers actually at Kalpting Bank. I had two of my really strong SAP consultants at Kalpting Bank when it went bankrupt in the subprime crisis in 2008. So I just kind of got the model ready. I'd got the first customers and I got everything ready. And then, of course, 2008 happened and the market disappeared. Worse in a way than the COVID has. It was worse then. It was like really difficult. But then we kind of grew there. Then when it kind of the market expanded, we were ready. We had everything. We had become a strong organization in the difficult times. And then it's actually easier to scale in the good times. So if you can make it in the COVID, when COVID then relaxes, then you're ready to take the growth.
Awesome. And I always like to ask guests, what books or what podcasts are you listening to right now or have you listened to that you think our audience would actually benefit from either reading or listening?
I'm reading a book called Sales for Noobs by John Sterling. Now, I know John Sterling personally from my previous company, and it's actually quite an interesting book. I mean, I should have read it 20 years ago. But I'm just reading it now and I'm having a laugh reading it. But otherwise, I do mostly read educational books, so something about the subjects. I'm watching a lot of YouTubes now when I kind of bored an evening about Google Talks, TED Talks, mostly kind of entrepreneur talks. And there's quite a lot of interesting insight. And you can just get a lot of information from people who've trodden a much bigger path than I have and seen what they've done and try to pick up from there. You can read all the books you want. And you can follow all the YouTubes you want, but there's nothing like being there. When you've got your own skin in the game and you're there and you've just got, like, both my companies started with a table and a box I sat on for a chair and a laptop. And you've got the whole world and you're like, how do I get a customer? And that kind of feeling is daunting and a lot of fun. And you can't learn it from a book or a course, or you just have to do it.
Yeah, I love it. It's skin in the game. That's 100% right. And listen, as we log off today, how can folk get in touch with you?
Well, we've got a website, which is www.inscale.net. And my email is mb for Belgium, v for Victoria, at inscale.net. And my phone number is 44 for UK, 7719555758.
Cool. Okay. So listen, if anyone wants to get in touch with Mark, you've got all of his details now. You give him a ring on the weekend as well after his tennis match.
not too early in the weekend.
Yeah. So listen, Mark, amazing. Love the story today. And finally, it was really great to get you on the show and have that chat and really open up around your journey and your entrepreneurship, I guess, path that you've taken. Awesome chat.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Richard. Cool. Take care.